From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Today, the U.S. Senate passed a bill designating the former nightclub as a national memorial site. Senators Rick Scott and Marco Rubio voted yes. The House passed the bill back in May. A nonprofit established by the owner of Pulse will be in charge of running the memorial and the museum.
It happened June 12, 2016, at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. As the community celebrated Pride Month, a heavily armed man entered the club and murdered 49 people, wounding another 53. On this fifth anniversary of the deadliest incident in the long history of violence against LGBT people in this country, I'll talk with Pulse owner Barbara Poma, who today is the CEO of the not-for-profit One Pulse Foundation.
White men built America, no matter what you're talking about. Architecture, automobiles, industry, medical, whatever. White men built America. Give credit where credit is due.
It's beyond easy to dismiss the rhetoric of today's political religious right as utterly incompatible with both democracy and the teachings of the major religions. But what if it's really not about either? A compelling commentary concluding that the true motivation behind the battles in today's culture wars is the preservation of white manism. No matter the demographic, ideological, and even logical odds, goes a long way towards explaining what we're seeing happen. And it also sounds a very serious alarm. The writer is the Reverend Peter Larman, who will be back with us later in the hour.
So what we're looking for is that every single immigrant, no matter his origin, should have a path to citizenship. And in order to get this, what we're trying to do is to put pressure on the Congress so they can include the immigration reform in the package that is being discussed right now in the Congress.
On Wednesday, a nationwide faith fast for freedom was launched to address the ongoing plight of undocumented people in this country, a plight made exponentially worse by the deliberate actions of the previous administration, as well as by the COVID-19 pandemic. The three-week fast is spearheaded by the nonprofit Faith in Action and the We Are Home campaign, and we'll get details from organizer Padre Vidal Rivas. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. When Barbara Poma and Ron Legler opened the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida in 2004, the venue already had a memorial component. Barbara lost her brother to AIDS years before, and his memory was ever present in the personality of the Pulse. Now, Barbara is deeply involved in another memorial effort located at the same address but global in scale. With the call to Outlove Hate, she's the CEO. of the One Pulse Foundation, and I am very grateful to have Barbara Poma join us on this fifth anniversary of the tragedy of June 12th, 2016. Barbara, I am so very sorry for the friends and loved ones that you lost on that terrible day. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your energies are focused today on building a National Pulse Memorial designed to be much more than just a somber memorial. Please explain what all you want to do.
At the foundation, we feel like it was really important to figure out how to achieve our mission in its fullest sense. And so, of course, the first thing is the memorial, the National Pulse Memorial, which will sit at the Pulse Nightclub site. It will be a beautiful, open, public park, you know, free to everyone 7 days a week to come sit and reflect, pay your respects, and bear witness to what happened there. The second part of the mission is to build the Pulse Museum. And we often get asked, why a museum? And I often say, I know museum is a scary word. It comes with a lot of connotation that for people who may or not visit museums or frequent them, to understand that truly what we want to build is an education institute, a place where people can come and learn about LGBTQ plus history, its struggles, its progress, its goals, to learn about why Pulse was so important, you know, creating that safe space for this community and what that truly means before everything was supposed to be a safe space. And then we also have education programs and legacy scholarships. So through our education programming, we really are trying to teach people in a behavioral modification level about accepting each other and learning that we are way more alike than we are different. It's really important people could start realizing that we may watch the same Netflix series, we may read the same books, we may both be parents, right? There's lots of ways that we are so much more alike. And so I think that's important for that. And then our fourth pillar would be our legacy scholarships. There are three phases to this project. The first phase will be the Orlando Health Survivors Walk that will trace the steps of survivors from Pulse Nightclub to the trauma center front doors. Talks that linear park will break ground first. We're doing that in conjunction with Florida Department of Transportation and the city of Orlando and OUC, who already have work happening there. So you'll see that break ground first. That project will take a year, and we'll be breaking ground that whenever we're on their timelines. Whenever that happens, that happens. And the phase two would be to build the Pulse National Memorial. We're not sure when we'll break ground on that. You know, initially we thought we'd be finished with that next year, but you know, COVID, just like everybody else, and COVID played a role in our timeline. And so we just really now are in this time of reassessing what that looks like to make it happen. And then the museum will actually is phase three and will start last. And that will take 2 years to build. So it's going to take some time, but we'll get there.
Barbara, why was it so important for you to work on this legacy? It must have been so painful to stay so deeply connected to this place and this tragedy. Why do it?
Why do it? I get asked that question a lot. And I think that truly and honestly is because I was so connected to Pulse, and I was so connected to this community, the LGBTQ community of Orlando. And it's because it was personal to me. And I really wanted to manage this project, but I have to tell you that it's not my project. You know, this is the community's project. It is led by not only this foundation and the team here, but tons of committees and board members and community people. And of course, our stakeholders, our families and survivors and first responders are first and foremost at the table to make these decisions.
I know there have been many moving events throughout the community in the last couple of weeks, all leading up to this fifth anniversary. Would you describe one or two of the events, and are any of them available to the public online as recordings?
Sure. You know, we started the week off with our community rainbow run, which was on June 5th. And we always start the week the Saturday prior to the shooting with the run. It really is a way for the community to come together. We had over 2,000 people on site. We had almost 1,000 people attend virtually. And yes, you can actually see it virtually online and see some video clips and do the run virtually. Still can sign up to do that if you want to participate. We had people from almost all 50 states, and I'm not sure how many countries participate in that. But it is like almost like a mini pride, and it's wonderful to see the community come together. I mean, it's colorful, it's happy. Families and survivors and first responders run or walk for free. And so and we have a beautiful festival. So that is one of the most, I think, to me, the uplifting. It's the event that fills your soul before you enter into this week, right, of remembrance. There have been many other events. We have one at least one a day. So I encourage everyone to go back and look at the calendar. Most of the events were live streamed. There probably are recordings for them. We held an incredible event last night at St. Luke's Church. On Wednesday evening, we held an event at St. Luke's Church to talk about faith and the intersection with the LGBTQ community, which is a program we're starting here at One Pulse to get faith leaders talking to and learning the vernacular and learning how to welcome LGBTQ people into the communities, into their congregations. So that is something that means so much to me personally, and I'm so glad we're doing that work. And so that too can be, you can watch that was recorded, and you can watch that live stream. I promise you it will be an eye opener.
Barbara, what are the concrete ways that people can get involved in supporting the work of building the Pulse Memorial and the mission of the One Pulse Foundation?
There are tons of ways to be involved with that project, the design and construction of the memorial and museum itself. Not only do we have committees that people serve on, but we have listening sessions with our storytelling. We call them our storytellers. They're really our interpretive planning firm. But they hold these listening sessions for the public to come and talk about what they want to see and feel, what's important to them and what's not. They hold private sessions, of course, with our immediate stakeholders. That's another way to be heard and be brought to the table. Of course, you know, helping us fund it is always a great challenge. And we really developed something that gives everyone an opportunity to do that. I'm sure you yourself have gone into other museums and you go to that beautiful wall when you first walk in, that marble wall that has all the people who made this possible, right? And we know that takes a large check, and not everyone is able to write a check of $1,000 plus. So we developed something here called Outlove Hate, and we talked about that a little bit. But Outlove Hate gives people an opportunity to become part of a permanent donor wall. It's a digital donor wall for $49. And so your face and your photo will be there, and your commitment statement of how you choose to Outlove Hate will be in perpetuity inside the museum, that you can come search your name. Your family generations from now can come search your name. And so that puts you there in perpetuity for $49. And that's never been done before in an institution where you can join a donor wall at that price.
Great idea. Yeah. I'd like for you to talk about the Pulse Memorial Scholarships and the vision that led to this part of the foundation's work.
Sure. You know, the Legacy Scholarship Program was born out of conversations with families of our victims. You know, they would repeatedly say to me, you know, I do not want my child's name just to be read once a year on June 12th. It's beautiful. We're building a memorial museum where their lives and stories will be told, but they were more than just this name on a wall. You know, they truly were. They had aspirations and careers, and they had goals that they were not able to achieve because their lives were cut so short. And some of them had achieved their goals. Some did own businesses and were practicing and doing their work, but some were not. And so what we did was we developed 49 individual scholarships in each of the angels' names. And their designation is what their family member chose in their honor. Amanda Alvier wanted to become a nurse and a midwife, and she was unable to achieve that. And so her scholarship, her family designated to nursing. And so we have scholarships that range from cosmetology to EMT to law, finance, accounting, communications, all the way up to medical school. So it's an amazing array of scholarships. We've awarded two rounds. They are open to everyone. They're inclusive, just like Pulse was. You do not need to be LGBTQ+ to apply for these scholarships. They are nationwide, so it's not just for Florida schools. They're trade schools and any accredited college or university. And of course, families and survivors and first responders get preference in those application process. So it is You know, you'll find 18-year-olds going off to school, and you'll find 25-year-olds going back or going for their doctorate or master's. So it is so inspiring. It's one of the best things we do so far.
Hmm. Barbara, the simple motto, out love hate, is so relevant today all over the country, actually all over the world, when it comes to resisting the flood of bias, bigotry, and violence that is targeting LGBTQI plus persons and others. Could I ask you to just speak from the heart about what that phrase, outlove hate, means to you, how the idea has helped you personally and so many of the other members of the community get through these past 5 years, and how you would encourage our listeners, wherever and whoever they may be, to live into this powerful idea and mission, out love hate.
Sure. You know, shortly after the shooting, I had said in an interview, I think, because I was a little bit of a shock and fog back then, I had said that, you know, we will not let hate win. And that really became the credo of the foundation. And so for 5 years, we've been saying we will not let hate win. And the question is how? How are we going to achieve that goal? And we know we're going to achieve it through education. We're going to achieve it through helping people, you know, learn more about the community. But really, to sum it up, how? You out love it. And that means you welcome people to your table, that you find how your commonalities, that you listen to others, that somehow we find this way back to that little gray area, which is not so black and white. Either I'm with you or I'm not. It means so much to me if people could just go back into that old cliche of it's okay to agree to disagree. It's okay. Doesn't mean I hate you. I still respect you. I love you. I hear you. I still have my feelings, but I hear you. And I think that, you know, I think faith plays a huge role in that. And all faith is based on love. And if we can understand that, you know, love itself can do so much. You know, I think the LGBTQ plus community wants to not just be accepted, but they want to belong. They want to feel welcomed. They want to feel that true acceptance. And that really does come from love. And I think it's important that we all commit to finding a way to do that, whether it's, talking to people who are unlike you, whether it's, you know, attending things that you would not, are out of your comfort zone. And so, you know, people are mostly afraid of or will criticize someone or something because they don't know about it or they don't know someone who lives in that community. I guarantee you, you know someone in the LGBTQ plus spectrum. They're everywhere. I talk about this all the time. You know, they are in sports. They're in law. They're your doctors. They're your nurses. They're your teachers. They live in every category. It's just that people don't realize it, and they don't seek to know. And I promise, when you meet someone and you just know them as a human, you're going to realize that you have a lot in common with them. It's okay to be you, you know, and so it's okay for them to be them. So I hope that people will learn to make this commitment to outlive hate and try something new.
Barbara Poma is the CEO of the One Pulse Foundation, with the mission to create and support a memorial that opens hearts, a museum that opens minds, educational programs that open eyes, and legacy scholarships that open doors. Its vision is to establish a sanctuary of healing and a beacon of hope by memorializing the lives taken, the lives saved, and all the lives affected by the Pulse nightclub tragedy of June 12, 2016, ensuring Pulse's legacy of love lives on forever. For more information, visit onepulsefoundation.org/. Barbara, I can't thank you enough for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, letting us be a part of what you're doing, which is so important and so love elevating. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
we're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Peter Larman on white manism, and later, Padre Vidal Rivas will tell us about the faith fast for freedom. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gay.
Everybody's got a pulse.
The Reverend Peter Larman's writing has always been incisive, witty, and articulate. His latest piece for Religion Dispatches, however, is also alarming. The term white manism is new to me, but it has already been dismissed by some as a too clever piece of academic wordplay. I can't blame anyone for getting distracted by semantics when the issue is so grave and as daunting as the wholesale campaign to redefine both religion and democracy in the service of a dwindling dominant majority. But I know Peter far too well to dismiss this analysis for that or any other reason. And so I'm pleased to welcome the Reverend Peter Larman back to State of Belief Radio. Peter, thanks for joining us again.
A great pleasure to be back.
Let's dispense with the obvious here. We ourselves are both white men of a certain age, and there's a lot of privilege that's gone along with that accident of birth. So draw the line, please, between race and gender on the one hand and the political impulse of desperately preserving that privilege at all costs, which is what your piece is about.
Well, yes. I mean, I've waded into some fairly deep water here, and not with any regret, but there's been an interesting exchange since my piece appeared. And I'm going to publish not a correction exactly, but a clarification that race and gender can't be left out of any sound analysis of what's going to be required to be honest with ourselves and build our movement for change around clarity and honesty and reparation. There's no other word for that. So white manism, yes, struck some people as badly off because it emphasized racial domination over capitalism. And for a lot of people on the progressive side, it's like, well, we need to stop all of that racial focus because it's a distraction from the main business of bringing people together. But of course, if you don't bring people together honestly and with the reality of our history in the background, you can't get anywhere. It's actually the case, Welton, that white people in the 19th century in particular talked all the time about it being a white man's country, the necessity for maintaining white male power above all, and they did a pretty good job for themselves, if you think about it. Now, we tend to, you know, put that century in rose-colored glasses and say, well, it was a great century of democratic reforms and industrialization and, America being an exemplar to Europe. Yes, but all of that history has now come under question and really for good reason.
The arguments that are being used today to attack any threat to white manism have evolved over time through trial and error. What's the core set of values or beliefs that undergirds this whole movement?
Yeah, well, it's that, in fact, white male power in the sweep of history has been a problem. It's caused immense amounts of suffering It's based on a zero-sum idea that what I've got, what I can hold, what I can take, what I can grab is limited, right? It's based on an economy of scarcity. From a religious point of view, it's based on bad theology, we might say, right? Whereas theologically, we believe in shared abundance. We think there's more when you share. But that's not how white manism works. So it's possessiveness. Is a catastrophe, really, for other people and for the planet. So obviously, its time has come. A good friend talks about 500 years is enough. Well, 500 years is basically the run of white manism, and it, of course, corresponds to the colonial project in the Western Hemisphere.
What happened that caused you to say, I've got to write this piece?
Well, I'm worried. I'm worried. You know, I talk to a lot of people. I live near a university campus. I talk to a lot of very educated, sophisticated people, faithful media followers and so forth, who are not in the least worried now that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are certified constitutional leaders. They feel the course has been righted. The nightmare of Trump and January 6th is now in the rearview mirror. I don't see it quite that way. I'm not a pessimist, but I don't underestimate the tenaciousness and the determination and the passion of the people in this heritage project, as they call it, right, who influence state legislators on voter procedures and also on gerrymandering. This is a long game. And when you have seemingly the entire Republican Party, with very few exceptions, committed to what is essentially an anti-democratic path, that's got to give you pause, I mean, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sanguine about us being totally out of the woods. I mean, I'm delighted that we avoided the total apocalypse. But yeah, we've got a long way to go. The House is in play. The Senate is hanging by a thread. This so-called new day could be over, you know, in a
Peter, talk about the concrete ways you see race as the common theme of these different agendas for the political religious right.
So many ideas about gender relations, what we call patriarchy, turn out to be implicated themselves in a racialist, as Europeans would say, a racialist consciousness. So women's work is undervalued. Well, for a long, long time, a lot of women's work was actually black labor, and those things are related. So, for example, when the Wagner Act was passed in 1935, allowing organizing to go forward, the categories of work that were dominated by people of color were excluded. Race plays into the control of women's bodies. It plays into labor relations. It plays, honestly, into the environmental struggle, because if you look at the most powerful fossil fuel corporations and their friends, their legislative advocates, overwhelmingly white men. And then religiously, how Christianity plays into it. Well, I participated in the thing that Robbie Jones did with Kristen Dume, the scholar, about evangelicals and where they're at. They're all in. I mean, they're doubling down on this same sort of project of the election was stolen, therefore we need to disenfranchise people. It's a remarkable thing. It's not reality based, but it is reality based in, if you accept that white manism is a reality in the culture, it's very much reality based in that sense, in that lamentable sense.
Peter, I'd like to ask you also to address the gender aspects of this, including the attempts to just erase the very existence of trans identities.
Yes. And I thank you for that, Welton, because, again, that's very deep water. But people talk sometimes about white fragility. There's also a kind of male fragility in our country. Many powerful men, again, white men, who actually have a fantasy life that involves crossing gender boards, that involves gender fluidity, they're so panicked by that. You know, this their sex panic is real. They're so panicked by that, and they're so intimidated by the religious ideation that they absolutely have to have a binary world. The cruelty of that is almost unimaginable if you really think about how it plays out. And I don't think it can stand indefinitely. But in the meantime, I'm told that there's now a backlash against the U.S. military because it's, you know, too soft on these and other matters, too willing to consider the appeals of trans people and, the appeals of people of color for a more nuanced view of what the military enterprise is about.
So where does all of this lead us if these people get their way?
Are you familiar with The Handmaid's Tale? It's a pretty dystopian thing. I mean, the cases that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear, basically, I think starting with Mississippi, but you know the rest of them, are basically designed to simply open the door to state restrictions that will be instantaneous in more than half the legislatures. Many legislatures have a Me Too thing that's standing by. So if Texas does this, they'll do it too, right? Up to this issue of the heartbeat. I mean, it's really unbelievable. My life long, I served at the Judson Church in New York. I'm associated with the people who, on the religious side, who talked about the dignity and judgment and moral autonomy of women, and therefore, you know, fought these horrific bans on not only abortion, but reproductive health more broadly. And here we are at the brink of all of that being washed away. I don't know if people, you know, I guess, you know, we've got so many crises that bear down on us. It's hard to be clear on this one, but this would be more than catastrophic. I mean, it would be horrendous. It would take this industrial democracy and take us to the back of the line worldwide. What could we even say to other countries that have, you know, religiously informed repressive laws if we do this?
This may lead us into a redundancy because I'm going to ask a question that may take us right back there. All of this stuff is alarming, but what is the most urgent part of this, and are there any effective ways to push back?
There are, and the many people are on this. I'm one of millions who say that the fight for the franchise, and it may be that H.R. 1 is not the vehicle. I mean, people can debate that. Maybe that the John Lewis Act should have gone first. I'm not here to debate that, but the fight for the franchise broadly has to be the most basic, because without that, nothing else happens, right? If we lose what we have of democracy, there's no way we can check corporate power. There's no way we can check fanatical religious repression. We can't do it. We are then utterly reduced to lack of agency. Lack of agency is... you see it all over the world. It's not a pretty sight.
So what's the role for faith leaders and faith communities here?
Faith communities are spaces where people can handle the truth, so to speak, right? They're safe spaces for truth-telling and for community despite difference. And they've got to be places where people are, you know, allowed to be both highly motivated to be part of change and unafraid. I think the gift of fearlessness in God's love, resting in God's love and resting in God's truth, is the greatest gift of faith communities. It's not always what they say and do. It's the spirit they enable that keeps hope alive. I really feel that strongly, and I really regret that a fair number of faith communities, now that they're, you know, kind of back open for business, are simply that, right? I mean, they're at the level of welcome back, but they're not at the level yet of welcome back, let's join the struggle.
Yeah. I can't let you go without asking for a few words on what you describe as flimsy liberalism in your headline. What is that?
Well, I think we've been talking about it, Welton. It's the rearview mirror, write a check, wave at Stacey Abrams, do a few things, and then thank God that's over, and thank God we can go back to normal life. That old Yeats line about the worst having passionate conviction and the best lacking passion, that's kind of our problem. I hosted a reunion of people who graduated from college 50 years ago. Most of us were activists. And it was amazing. We didn't change the world as much as we thought we did, but we had that kind of impulse. And people, without exception, because I talked to a number of the people who attended, without exception, are deeply, deeply worried still about where we are.
Reverend Peter Larman is ordained in the United Church of Christ and is the former executive director of Progressive Christians Uniting in Los Angeles, California. His urgent warning in Religion Dispatches is headlined, "The Coup That Never Ends, White Manism and the Perils of a Flimsy Liberalism," and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Peter, it's great to be with you again, as always. Thank you for being on State of Belief Radio. Keep thinking like you think and writing like you write.
And you keep asking those questions, Weldon, because they're right on point. Thank you so much.
On Wednesday, a coalition of immigration activists joined together for a three-week national faith fast for freedom. I'm joined now by one of the leaders, Padre Vital Rivas of Hyattsville, Maryland.
Claro que sí. Estamos muy impresionados con la respuesta que se dio el día de ayer y llenos de gozo de ver al mismo tiempo el espíritu de los ayunantes y las personas que han venido a acompañarnos.
Yes, that's true, and we are really impressed of the spirit of all the fasters and also of all the community that has gathered here in this church in order to give us support.
Padre Vidal, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Gracias a usted por invitarme y hacerme parte de la radio y de todos los que escucharán este maravilloso programa.
Thank you for inviting me to this fabulous program, and thank you all of you that are listening to this fabulous program.
Why a fast? Why did this seem like the right tactic to raise up this urgent cause?
En primer lugar, el ayuno es saludable, es con espíritu religioso, es crítico y es profético. Sabemos que el presidente y que la mayoría de los congresistas y senadores son personas creyentes de fe, y un ayuno de oración es para despertar sensibilidad y conciencia de que se abra un camino a la legalización en este momento.
Yes, first of all, a fast is healthy, it's also very religious, and we know that is also critic and prophetic. We are informed that the President of the United States and also members of Congress and senators, they are all also believers. So we think that this is a great way to let them know what we need and why this is urgent.
Además, sabemos que el señor presidente, el día que él tomó posesión, fue a la Iglesia San Mateo, a la Catedral de Washington, como un creyente católico. Y queremos hacerle conciencia lo que dice Isaías 58, que el ayuno es romper las cadenas para que los inmigrantes caminen en libertad siendo legalizados.
And we also know that when Mr. President, Mr. Biden, got into office, he went to the Washington Cathedral, St. Matthew's, and we know that he is a believer. And because of that, we want him to understand exactly what Isaiah 58 means for us and for immigrants. And it is release them from the chains.
What are the specific goals of the Fast for Freedom?
La meta principal es que nuestros hermanos inmigrantes, sin importar el origen, sean incluidos en el camino a la ciudadanía, que sean incluidos en este paquete que viene este año, porque sabemos que si el gobierno no incluye o no hace nada en este año, difícilmente el próximo año en las elecciones estarán incluidos en política y no harán nada. Sabemos que este momento es el momento crucial y preciso y justo para nosotros.
So what we're looking for is that every single immigrant, no matter his origin, will be should have a path to citizenship. And in order to get this, what we're trying to do is to put pressure on the Congress so they can include the immigration reform in the package that is going, it's being discussed right now in the Congress. We believe that the moment is now. Next year is going to be an election year, so we know they were not going to be paying attention to these issues.
Y a mí me encanta una reflexión que yo estaba haciendo. Siempre en todo país o en toda competencia, cuando alguien es un héroe o gana la competencia, se le premia con un trofeo o una medalla de oro. En este país, a los inmigrantes se les ha dado el título de esenciales, pero lo único que hemos logrado es que muchos inmigrantes mueran por la pandemia. Hoy es el momento que el gobierno pueda reconocerlos legalizándolos por justicia y por derecho.
And a reflection is that I have made is, in a country, a hero or a very well-known athlete, they receive like recognition, and it is usually like a gold medal. Now, the immigrants have been called essential workers, and the immigrants have made a great deal of work for this country and to keep the economy running. So what we think now that the right way to recognize the efforts that they have made is to guarantee them that they can have this path to citizenship. It's time, and it is now.
4 months into the Biden administration, do you think more should have already been done?
Claro que sí. Él está al alcance porque todavía tiene el Congreso y parte del Senado, pero yo creo que se ha quedado solamente en pequeños matices y las promesas de todo el tiempo de campaña debe cumplirse, porque hay que hacer honor a la palabra y él no puede ser uno más de la lista de los que mienten para llegar a la presidencia.
Absolutely, yes, he has control of the Congress, of the House, and also control of the Senate, almost control of the Senate. So he has to fulfill his promises. What he promised during the campaign, he has to honor that word and not be another politician that lies only to get votes.
Please talk about the effect this delay is having on millions of families in this country right now.
Pues es un efecto negativo. Las personas se encuentran en un limbo. Muchos hermanos inmigrantes se sienten sin paz, no tienen conciliación en el sueño, sobre todo los hermanos de DACA, del TPS, los trabajadores agrícolas y muchos que no tienen documentos viven en una zozobra porque no saben en qué momento los puede detener la migración o por un accidente de tránsito, pararlos la policía y después entregarlos a la migra. Eso es triste mientras los inmigrantes están trabajando y abonando a esta gran nación, que sabemos que es un gran país fuerte y formado por inmigrantes, los inmigrantes que han llegado hoy no son bien recibidos ni bien vistos. Y es importante que el país vaya a su historia, a su esencia, para nuevamente seguir siendo esa gran nación.
What I can say is that this puts a lot of pressure on all the immigrants, the undocumented ones, especially the ones that have DACA, TPS, or the farmers, because they are doing a great deal in order to help this country. This is a country that was built based on immigration, and this new immigration that's getting to this wonderful and great nation is not being well received. So they always live in fear. They even are afraid of driving. You can have a car accident, and that is going to put you in a situation where the police probably is going to send you afterwards to immigration, and they live in fear all the time. So it's time to change that and to honor the way this great nation was built based on immigration.
What are the groups that put together this fast and the entire campaign?
En primer lugar, Fe y Acción es el líder. Tenemos sindicatos, tenemos como organizaciones como Casa de Maryland y We Are Home y otras más, y personas individuales. Lo importante es de esta acción, que es interreligiosa. Personas de todas las religiones estamos incluidos, y de todo el área cristiana, sin importar denominación, porque lo que importa es primero que somos humanos, antes de formar parte de cualquier religión. El humanismo está sobre todo.
I will mention especially the leader in this action is Faith in Action. Also, we have other organizations like Casa in Maryland, and we have La Red, we have Firm in Action, we have a lot of organizations that are working together. This is an interfaith work. So we are from every single denomination. We have Christians, we have Jews, we have Muslims. Everybody is involved in this effort because we are all humans and we're fighting for a human right. And that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
How can our listeners find out more about the Faith Fast for Freedom?
Pueden hacerlo buscando en el www.feenaction. Ahí en la página pueden encontrar toda la información de lo que está sucediendo, de la red, Network, CAN. Lo importante es, pero con solo ir a Fe e Acción, puede encontrar toda la información de lo que está sucediendo.
So the best way to do so is to go to the website of Faith in Action. Or you can go also to La Red Network, but specifically the best way to go is to Faith in Action, and you can find out what you can do in your own community, what you can do in your own state, because this is not only in D.C., it's being replicated in different states.
Padre Vidal Rivas, what would you like everybody listening right now to do to help pressure our lawmakers for real change?
En realidad, que cada uno de los ciudadanos que pueden votar, como aquellos que no pueden votar, que llamen a sus delegados, a sus senadores, y que llamen, incluso si tienen la facilidad de hacerlo, al Congreso o al Senado o a la Casa Blanca, y luego que en la misma sociedad civil, en su entorno, hagan conciencia de la importancia de los inmigrantes y de la legalización. El otro elemento, que también si son personas de fe, puedan orar por todos los inmigrantes y para que el gobierno se sensibilice, y para aquellos que están hoy en ayuno, tengamos la fortaleza de seguir haciéndolo y tener esa conciencia. Ustedes pueden hacerlo tomando parte de su tiempo del día, y para que todo esto sea fructífero y logremos el objetivo que buscamos.
Voters or not voters, I want you to do is to call your congressman, call your senator, call every single person that is related with a public office in your area, and let them know about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and that this is urgent, that we need this change. Also, you know, talking to your community, let everybody know what is going on and why. And also pray for us, the ones that are right now fasting, and also pray to be able to make the government to take a different path, and also to accept that this change is urgent and it is now that it need to be made.
Y como el programa se va a transmitir este sábado y domingo, todavía es posible que puedan venir a ayunar aquellos que puedan, ya que son 3 semanas, pueden buscar Fe Acción y registrarse y venir a sumarse al grupo de los ayunantes.
Also, because this program is going to be aired Saturday and Sunday, there's still time that you can go to Faith in Action webpage and register to see if you want to join us here fasting, or fasting in your area, or just being a volunteer helping the ones that are fasting everywhere in the country.
Padre Vidal Rivas serves the Episcopalian Catholic Church in the San Mateo Parish, Hyattsville, Maryland. He is a leader in the Faith Fast for Freedom campaign, which started nationwide on Wednesday, June 9th.
Sí, claro que Padre, sí, originario de El Salvador para servirles.
Yes, and I'm here to serve you in the best way I can. I'm originally from El Salvador.
Padre Vidal, blessings on you and all who are working with you on what you're doing in this very important campaign. Thank you very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Gracias a usted en primer lugar por invitarse y tomarse ese tiempo y por hacer conciencia. Gracias a todos los que van a escuchar el programa, y que Dios les bendiga y siempre tengan lo justo y lo necesario. Y gracias por amarnos.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity and to taking your time in order to interview me. Also, I want to thank everyone that is listening to this program. I want to give you my blessings also, and thank you for all the support that I'm sure that we're going to receive from your listeners.
Great to be with you.
De la misma manera, que Dios les bendiga.
It's a pleasure for me also. God bless you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week. One person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.